Welcome to the Plastic Please Me Store podcast.
We are your hosts, Trey the Explainer.
And me, Miles Greb.
A podcast about the natural world.
Things that people claim are part of the natural world.
And things that used to be.
Okay, so we're back with another episode. This one's going to start a little different. We're not going to do a normal science stories. There was a current event, I guess, in the archaeology weird stuff world that we like to cover. And we actually have a special guest on to talk about an event that happened on social media.
And now it's time for another Plastic Plesiosaur podcast interview.
Flint, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, yeah, I'm Flint Dibble, and I'm an archaeologist. I study ancient Greece, and I've worked on projects across the Greek world and the Roman world, and I try to do outreach on Twitter by writing Twitter threads about my own archaeological research and about other people's archaeological research and things like that, yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, so you definitely have a background in this. Yeah.
I guess I should give – I start my new job tomorrow at Cardiff University. I am a Marie Curie fellow.
Cool.
So I don't have an affiliation today when you're interviewing me, but I will tomorrow.
Okay, well, this won't be out for about 2 weeks, so we'll just
– No, it's fine, yeah.
Yeah. So apparently – you know, we cover Monster Quest on this show at the end, kind of like for a fun gag at the end. So we're kind of in deep into the History Channel, Discovery Channel, you know, non-science-based programming, you know. And so there was a new show, correct? This Hunting Atlantis?
Yeah, it's a new show that I guess is on the Discovery Channel, and it was airing through most of August. They had 6 episodes.
Mm-hmm. What do you think makes this show stand out from other shows? Like, why is this of interest?
Well, it's of interest, I think, because at least from my perspective as an archaeologist, it's about pseudo-archaeology. So it's mm-hmm. it's about fake archaeology in a sense. And when the show was announced in May, the two co-hosts, or the host Del Pavlo and the co-host Jess Phoenix, were advertising it because they had a bunch of scholars on the show. And several of these scholars were colleagues of mine. And so I and other people became a little intrigued about this, what's going on with this. And so what happened was Del, he had written a paper on how he has redated Atlantis to a different time period, in a sense. So Atlantis is, well, first off, I should always say it's just not a real place.
It's a parable.
It's an allegory that's introduced by Plato in his dialogues, who is not a historian. He does not tell histories. He's a philosopher, of course. And in these dialogues, he introduces this story of Atlantis to make a philosophical point. We can go back to that in a second if we want to get into the nitty gritty of that. But sure. What Stell has done is he has written what he considers an academic paper that is apparently going to be published in the Journal of Archaeomythology. And that's what this show is based upon. And his suggestion is that Plato, in the story, Critias is the interlocutor that's talking. And he says that his grandfather told him that this Athenian politician Solon told him that he heard from Egyptian priests about
this
sort of
thing.
Yeah, exactly. And throughout, they're also saying this is a made-up thing. It's part of this ideal war, whatever, between Athens and a place that's not real. But he says it takes place 9,000 years before him. So that would be about 9,600 BCE. And Stell's claim in this paper is that it's the timeline is wrong and Plato somehow was mixing up something, or maybe the priests that Plato was talking to were mixing up something, the king list specifically. And that means that actually Atlantis took place in about 5,000, 4,500 BC. And that's the bold claim that the show is centered on. And so they go visit a lot of archaeological sites from Bulgaria, Turkey, Greece, Croatia, and they visit real archaeological sites, real ongoing archaeological research with top scholars. And then they try to say that these could be potential Atlantises, let's say. right? Because they date to that period.
So it's the mainstream opinion, of course, and I believe it's Trey and my opinion as well, that, you know, this place basically has no chance of possibly existing.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, like I said, it's just a parable. So, like, I guess what my question is, why does he think that the date would matter? You know, like,
I'm not sure, because like the show, even like every single episode starts off, archaeologists have not been looking in the wrong place. They've been looking in the wrong time.
Yeah. And good tagline. I mean,
you know, yeah, it's a great punch letter tagline, you know, but it's sort of like all the Atlantis theories out there. They pull out places that date to all kinds of times, you know, right. Like
I've heard of the one where it's like Minoan Crete, like before the Bronze Age collapse or during it.
So it's So Santorini, it's a site that's associated with the Minoans. It's an island just north of Crete. A huge volcano goes off. There's a big debate about the exact year it goes off, but let's say 1600, 1500 BCE. Certainly not 9600 BCE, but that's like one of the most popular claims for Atlantis, right?
Sure, because you know you have a an event in the past that is cataclysmic that you can point to. So
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And so... And at first I wanted nothing to do with this. I was just sort of like, you poke a bee's nest or a hornet's nest and weird things happen. And to be honest, I'm not an Atlantis scholar, though now I've researched a whole lot on it. but what got me was A, I saw that one of my friends was on the show, and then B, I saw his hypothesis was dating it to 4500 BCE. And I said, you know what, that's not my main specialization. I study animal bones, though, so I work on sites from that period. I work on sites from later periods. What I have studied closely is the archaeology of Athens. And in the story, it's a war between Athens and Atlantis. And so I'm thinking
– plus gods.
Yeah. Well, no, the only god thing is when Zeus destroys Atlantis.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not like the Trojan War where it's like a myth. And so – But I thought, you know what, I know a whole lot about Athens. So if he's really trying to say that this takes place at this time, there's no way it could be, because Athens doesn't match that, right? You know, this is the first people living in Athens at the time. We have our sum total is like 15 wells full of trash and no buildings, no nothing. It's just some pottery, some animal bones. They've all been published. They're all open access. Anybody can go read them and see the photographs of them all. There's one really cool figurine, and that's it. That's what we have from this time period in Athens. Yeah. And so I sort of thought, all right, well, that's my in. I can do research on what Stell wrote. I can see how he wrote it up, and then I can talk about how there's – and then I can present what's going on in Plato and how the interlocutors in Plato make it clear that this is not a true story. In a sense, the setting, you guys know Plato's Republic, right?
Yes. Yeah, I'm and a that's nerd. I've read all the stuff.
All right, perfect. So, you know, Plato in there, Socrates and several different people, they have a big discussion about how to create an ideal city. And so the setting here is like it's supposed to take place the next day or something like that, maybe 2 days later. And it's Socrates with a couple other people, Timaeus and Critias, and they're sort of saying – all right, we've created this ideal city, but now we want to see what it would do, in warfare. And so what they do is they say, all right, let's pretend that the ideal city we created yesterday is Athens, and then let's create a city that's the opposite of it, and that's Atlantis. And then let's sort of see what happens, and that's sort of how it all – that's the setting for – the whole description of Atlantis and the whole description of Athens is that kind of simulation.
The story kind of cuts off at the end, right?
Yeah. So it does cut off. Happened. No, we don't. We know that Zeus is about to destroy it, and that's about it.
Yeah. Well, you imagine Zeus wins.
Oh yeah. I mean, yeah. He. When does he lose? He hurled his thunderbolt. He's locked those suckers in a vault. They're trying on his own. Stop chaos. Finish
track. Yeah, so you were sent this paper he wrote then, right? And so you perused it. Like, obviously this person isn't a scientist, you know, he's a writer. But, you know, I'm a writer of fiction myself, you know, so I try to do sci-com from an enthusiast level. So I have some sympathies for that, but I don't think I would try to write a paper then pass it off as publishable. And I would then be extremely sensitive to criticism instead of kind of pushing it away, because I'd probably be unsure of my findings. How do you think this person has responded to criticisms of his findings? The chuckle.
Not very generously, not well. I suppose.
Okay.
I mean, I've worked with a lot of amateurs. It depends on how you define amateur, but let's say people without degrees. And there are many fantastic amateurs in the field of archaeology. In fact, I've had some of them guest lecture in my classes. I had a digital humanities class last year, and we were using this website that maps out every single place reference geographically in ancient texts. Okay. And it's put together by a former diplomat that lived in Greece. And he's spent a lot of time studying archaeology and stuff like that. And he's a fantastic guy. And he put this all together, but he knows
Flint is not in America right now, and so his internet's dropping out. So we cut out a bit there, but now we are jumping back into the conversation.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. So
that's okay.
Yeah, I was talking there are several amateurs that contribute in a fantastic way to archaeology. I mean, all over the world. And so I don't think there's a problem with amateurs doing archaeology, whether it's coming on excavations or whether it's actually doing reading and publishing.
Or dynamiting Troy.
Yeah, so, well, that I have a problem with.
Well,
there's a lot of problems there. Stealing the treasure.
Schliemann.
Yeah. But that actually brings up a good point, is that that's kind of my issue is with people that do ethically dubious things, right?
Yeah.
Right.
And so I would consider pseudo-archaeology to be ethically dubious. And if you're going to be doing this in good faith, I would hope that you would want to have a chat with experts. And take criticism. And respond to it and adapt your thinking if you have some criticism. And so, yeah, that was obvious, or not obvious, I guess, to anyone who's listening, but to anyone who was on Twitter, on archaeology Twitter this last week, that was definitely the case.
So could you detail some of your criticism? So I believe his premise is that it's basically the Back to the Future. It's not where, Morty, it's when, and like...
Yeah.
Yeah, so he's saying that we've been looking in the wrong time because he has a chart of Egyptian kings that he says was mathematically compiled wrong to create a misunderstanding of the time scale. And so we need to look at a different time for this fictional place.
And
obviously we don't believe the place is real, so we don't need to address that premise. But just if you were to look for this place, you think he's looking in the wrong place anyway, and you had some criticisms of it, right?
Well, yeah, like what is their interpretation of? Is it like a Greek colony or something like that?
Well, it's sort of like his whole idea. That's why it's hunting Atlantis, is now that we have this different timeline, we should just look all over for it and see if we can find a place at that time period, 5,000, 4,500 BC, around there-ish, that fits it, right? And I can't really, I'm not an Egyptologist, so I am not able to critique his analysis of the Egyptian king list, and I didn't even touch that. I'd be intrigued to see what an Egyptologist thought about that.
That reminds me of, like, so we had Jeff Meldrum on, who's basically the world leader in Bigfoot apologetics, right? And he has all these, like, really detailed stuff about the footprints, but I'm like, I don't really care about how specific your research in the footprints go, because like I have no reason to believe they're actual footprints. So like it's just a bunch of jargon that requires a lot to refute that I don't think we even need to refute. So
yeah,
it's kind of the same as that Egyptian timeline. So
I mean, that's kind of my thinking too. And then what he did do other research on, and I mean, to be honest, to give Stell credit, he did read a lot of academic literature.
Yeah,
a lot of it was out of date, but not all of it. And and he cited it for the most part properly, depending on what you define a citation, meaning like his citations were correct, but he'd have a lot of statements that desperately needed citation. And so, for example, in the paper, in the lecture he gave, and in the show, he keeps saying that after 2500 BCE, the known world changed from circular settlements to gridded settlements. And that's one of his, smoking gun arguments that his hypothesis is correct. It must be yada, yada, that early. It can't be something like Santorini, right? Which is somewhat gridded. But on the other hand, that's just not true. There are most
importantly,
yeah, and he even says in Plato's time, Plato would never have even thought about a gridded settlement or a circular settlement because he would have only seen gridded settlements around. And well, Athens was a circular city, right? And it grew up organically, so it doesn't really have a clear grid. Its port, Piraeus, the port city that was established, you know, from scratch in 490 BCE, that is a gridded settlement. But Athens itself, where Plato is, was not. And so it's just kind of like most settlements were not. And so there's a lot of statements like that that provide context. And so that's where consulting, let's say, an academic is really important because we have spent a long time learning about the broader context of, say, 5000 BCE Greece, right? And so even though my specialty is several thousand years later, I know a whole lot about that time period because I study animal bones from that time period. I've worked on projects from that period and I teach that period. And so I know the broader context of what's going on then. And that's kind of what's lacking in the paper is the larger context. And that's actually what I'd say is common with pseudo archaeology in general. They focus, like you said, on the footprints for Bigfoot or the pyramids, and there's all these different pyramids that look alike. And
the pyramids are proof of anything you want them to be proof of, is what I have come to understand.
Or like they'll get like a single inscription that vaguely looks like a helicopter or something like that.
Oh yeah, exactly. I've seen that on social media. Yeah, exactly.
Pareidolia is a hell of a drug.
Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's that lack of context, and then also not engaging with critiques. So he cited this fantastic paper by, I think it's Donald Johansson, and it's about Plato's Atlantis, Truth, History, and Lies. And it basically goes through the entire Plato dialogues about Atlantis and explains how there's this tongue-in-cheek game where sometimes they call this a lie in fiction and other times they call it a true history, right? It's this tongue-in-cheek thing of saying, hey, yeah, we're trying to pretend that this is a real history by building up this kind of historiography and stuff. But they stated several times that it's false and there's mistakes with it and things like that. And so he cites that paper, but he doesn't address it at all. And so that's what I would say is the problem with scholarship in general. And then my own contribution, sorry, was Athens, the archaeology of Athens.
What is this journal he's trying to publish in? Is this like a predatory journal? Is this kind of one of the pay for print journals, or is this a journal that you have a respect for? Like, is it pretty well weighted? Or
no, I'd never heard of it before. It's called Journal of Archaeomythology. And I think they're trying to publish hypotheses on archaeology and mythology, which is a really tough field to approach anyway. You're talking about mythology, which is, you know, stories, let's say, which might have a kernel of truth and might not. And so it's difficult to pick apart what's true and what's not in a myth. And you're trying to compare it to archaeology. And so I think that the kind of stuff that goes in there is the stuff that would not be placed in a journal that I'd normally read in a library and things like that. But I've never heard of it, so I don't have much on it.
And I assume that this would pass peer review yet in this journal, whatever they
peer review. They don't mention on their website that there's peer review. But when people were talking to Stella about this on Twitter, maybe even me, I mentioned that it had not passed peer review. And so he said that I was lying, and he posted a screenshot of an email from the editor when he submitted it, I guess, when he submitted a question, does this journal have peer review? And they said yes.
Answer that question.
Who are the peers that are reviewing it is also the question, right?
Yeah, definitely. Because there's like alt-med journals and Bigfoot journals and stuff. It doesn't mean anything to...
Like, who is peer reviewing makes a big difference, right?
Definitely. Right.
And you know, peer review is not a perfect process, but it's, you know, we try to get as many steps we can to get in there to get towards the truth. So.
And so I published this thread debunking it in May, and then it sort of went silent. The show was supposed to be released in June, and then it was mysteriously delayed. And then all of a sudden it came out in August. And I had a rough summer with health issues. And so I said, I was in Philadelphia at my mom's house. And I said, all right, I'm going to watch this. Why not? And let's see what's going on. And I quickly realized what the trick was. When you watch the show, you don't need, if you're just thinking about it, say skeptically, let's say, and you look at the conversations that the hosts are having with the qualified archaeologists, the word Atlantis never comes up. It's never brought up. It's a legitimate interview about the research of the specialist. And then it cuts away to just the two co-hosts and like, you know, in a different room and things like that. And then they talk about how those findings from the specialist confirm or disprove or whatever relate to this new chronology and Stell's hypothesis and things like that.
Yeah, and this is a trick that they do with a lot of different fields.
Monster Quest does it a little bit, I feel like.
Yeah, they had Captain Janeway do voiceovers for a non-heliocentric movie a while ago, you know, because she didn't really know what she was doing. She was just saying stuff about space. But then the movie's just like, you know, the sun rotates around the earth. That's her premise. You know, so she's like, wait, what was I in?
That's what this is like. And so, yeah. They did this. They got to really, really, really excellent archaeologists at top universities that are running top digs that are producing cutting edge research and results. And they basically went there and talked with them and conducted a legitimate interview about what they're working on and what they found. And then they edited it down and then they interspersed clips of the two co-hosts talking about Atlantis. And so I like I said, it's pretty obvious if you watch it, but you know, since I know some of these people and others, the archaeology is a small field.
Wow.
Yeah. So they're doing that Ben Stein thing. Ben Stein did for his Evolution Isn't True movie. He interviewed like Dawkins and then some other prominent biologists like P.Z. Myers and stuff. And then they had them say things like, oh yeah, it's very hard for evolution to work under these conditions and stuff, you know, like true things about how hard it is for phenotypes to successfully propagate. And then they just cut those parts. And then we ask people how likely is evolution to be true? And even biologists say it's super hard, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And there's even one scene where I was going over it today with a friend who's helping me look at this more closely, where they're interviewing somebody. And they're talking about, and this person says, oh yeah, there's some Neolithic sherds here that we found. And the camera pans away from the people. And all of a sudden, Stell's voice comes in, but at a different audio quality. And he says, that supports my date for Atlantis. And then it cuts back to the other audio quality of the interview itself. And so it was a total blindside to some of these scholars because, you know, nobody wants to ruin their reputation by being on
by looking for a metaphorical place.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And somehow what you're doing relates to it. And I mean, you know, the plot of the show is super hokey as well. I mean, you know,
it's a reality show about a couple looking for a fictitious place in the Mediterranean because it's fun, right?
They draw these weird connections that to an archaeologist is like, what are you talking about? That makes no sense. You just said that artifact comes from this area of Turkey. And now all of a sudden you're going to a completely different area of Turkey. Turkey's a huge country and you're on the complete opposite side. And it's like, come on.
That's the kind of things that's hard for an expert to keep track of and know, you know?
I don't know
all the parts of Turkey. I have no idea.
Oh, I was just saying a lot of these shows mess with the timeline and they talk really, really quickly and you're like, wait a second, that's 2,000 years later. That doesn't make any sense.
Exactly. Yeah. There's a review up online by Jason Colavito of the first episode. And that's his criticism is the site that they're looking at in Bulgaria dates to 4,000 BC, which would be 500 years later than what Stell gives as a later date. For this Atlantis thing. And so it's why are you even harping on this, right? And so, but it doesn't matter. They say, ooh, that's close enough.
So but they saw your criticisms, right?
I basically wrote a short little thread and I said, hey, I'd like you to answer some questions of mine. And I tagged them specifically saying, I'd like you to, Stel, Pavlo, and Jess Phoenix, I'd like you to answer some questions of mine. It's pretty clear from watching the show that you never brought up Atlantis to the scholars that you interviewed. And then that, I guess, rattled his chain. And right before I went to bed here on Thursday, this Twitter thread came out about me that was posted by his wife. And it was, I don't know how to say it other than it was extremely insulting. I would prefer to be polite instead of attacking this person's wife, but it was a rant, let's say.
They got personal and insulted your character.
And she did it in this way where she also, so my dad was an archaeologist, right? So the very first tweet talks about how my dad was a famous archaeologist. I am named Flint because my dad studied Neanderthal stone tools. My brother's
name is awesome.
Yeah, my brother's name is Chip. And so, you know, it's like a fun story. I always wanted to avoid the nepotism. So I got into classical archaeology, which is in a totally different department, Paleolithics and anthropology. Classical archaeology is in classics. So, you know, that way the people that were teaching me and advising me and instructing me, they didn't even know who my dad was. And so that's how it starts off. And my dad also passed away a few years ago, somewhat suddenly. And then it goes on and she basically tells me that I'm lying, insults me for harassing him, which everything I've done is very public. And I've just asked for questions and things like that. And then she goes on to say why she thinks this show is great because it will inspire future archaeologists. And then she ends it. I'm just going to have to read it because she starts off by saying there's this guy, we'll call him Flint Dibble. I understand his dad was a famous archaeologist. And instead of being happy that Discovery Channel is finally bringing science back to their channel, silly Flint just complains. Yeah. But Flint is a scientist, but he doesn't work at a research university. He takes pride in what he does. Which, that research university is ridiculous for two reasons. One, actually, I do. I just finished from Dartmouth, and now I'm going to Cardiff University. Two, that is ridiculous. I have lots of friends that work at teaching universities, and they do fantastic research. And so that is really insulting to people that do really excellent teaching. And then she goes on to say, however, he is really mad, and he throws really loud and noisy tantrums online. I recognize this because when my daughter was a little toddler, she acted very similarly. But I could always calm her down with a snack or put her down for a nap. But not Flint. He just keeps getting angrier and angrier. But why? He thinks that my husband's new show, Hunting Atlantis, is stealing something from him. So this goes on. And then she tells me how I want to make a name for myself just like my daddy. And therefore, I want to get the funding I want to do the things I want to do. But I've gone about it the wrong way. This isn't how you achieve things in life the right way, at least not in my book. This is how we teach our daughters. So then she goes on talking about how the show is inspiring future generations to become scientists and stuff like that. And so I skipped a whole bunch of tweets, but it ends here by saying, Flint will one day feel that when students come into his classroom and say what brought them there, it was because Stel Pavlo, or what will he feel when they say it was because Stel Pavlo inspired them?
Oh, screw you. like imagine how self-important you think. Oh,
Just wait a second.
Okay.
And now his show, Hunting Atlantis, has escorted that kid and put them in a seat in front of him to teach because one day I can assure you this will happen. So, Flint Dibble, I'm sending you to your room. Don't come out until you have thought about what and why you are doing this. Don't come back out until you can play nice with others. Oh, and stop hanging on to Stel Pavlo's coattails. It's embarrassing, actually, honey. And quite frankly, it doesn't look good on you. Mama out.
Who is this? What?
I don't know how to answer that.
Yeah, like, where do you even begin there?
I guess other than the sass and the drama of it, just the claims are, like is the show doing science? Right, like it does. It have a hypothesis that is being tested, and they're trying to disprove. Like, is there anything that the show has done to try to argue against its claim that first of all, Atlantis exists; second of all, that the time scale is totally different; or and third, they're looking for it in locations that make sense. Like, do they do anything to try to disprove this?
Well, you know, and that's what surprises me, because Stell on Twitter at least oftentimes says, you know, I'd like to just throw this out to scholars and see if it's just a hypothesis. I want to see how it works against the evidence. And that's why, to me, it strikes me as surprising that he never asked these scholars about his hypothesis, because he had them in the room with him, very smart people who are experts on this time period that he is investigating, and he could have asked them. And he didn't. So, you know, I don't know. To me, yeah, that's not science at all. That's just trying to craft your own narrative and make it fit, right?
Yeah, definitely.
So, how prevalent is Atlantis belief, like in, I don't know, these sort of pseudo circles, or just maybe in popular, broader general audiences?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's obviously popular because it shows up in Hollywood movies and comic books and things like that. Everybody knows about Atlantis, and it's been adapted a million times, right? And most of the time as fiction, of course. I mean, it was very popular of a nonfiction idea that scholars were testing in the 19th and early 20th centuries. But so it's well known.
There's an ocean named after it, right?
Yeah, the Atlantic. But the problem is that, you know, we live in a world right now where there's rising beliefs in conspiracy theories. And, different surveys have shown that in the last decade, I think Chapman University did one, they're showing that there's a rising belief, not just in the conspiracy theories that we see on the news that are impacting politics and things like that, but also Pizzagate, QAnon, whatever, but also a rising belief in things like Atlantis and ancient aliens. And so that this survey showed that in 2018, actually, the Atlantis belief was at an all-time high in the U.S. at 57% of respondents.
Damn.
Wow.
And so this is a problem, right? You know?
Yeah, it's been around for a long time. I mean, like, you had Casey, right, in the 60s and everything, and that like probably created a big spike as well. And people who don't know, Casey was a person who said he could sleep and then go into these like trances and he could prophesize. He made a whole bunch of predictions, but some of the most famous ones were he said he could see Atlantis.
Which, of course, is a compelling hypothesis, right?
Yeah, obviously that's good evidence. Let's go based on that. My English teacher in high school actually told me about this. Like, it was a true and interesting story.
Huh. I've actually never heard it, but it's pretty crazy, isn't it? It's just, and in engaging with people online has been a real trip.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you get people that are really into researching Atlantis for various, and they all have their range of beliefs. It's interesting to hear and see what they say about what I have to say when I try to sort of put it in a more teaching context where I'm writing about it, right, and explaining why it can exist.
I find pseudoscience to be, you know, like worth refuting and dangerous kind of on its face. I feel like when you start breaking the foundations of reality, it's like really easy to like get really bad opinions or dangerous opinions. Mm-hmm. But it seems that like Atlantis in particular has a history of especially doing that. Like there's a lot of groups that have kind of, you know, on the highest possible end of problematic opinions, have invested a lot into Atlantis.
Yeah, so the Atlantis story has a long history of being associated with pretty strong racism. You see this in Nazi Germany, where Himmler set up the Institute of Atlantis Studies and sponsored archaeologists to go all over the world to try to find Atlantis. And his idea were that these Atlanteans, these Atlantides, were actually the sort of mythical forebears of the Aryans. And so it was to help prove, because in the myth, these Atlanteans are pretty spectacular people, right? They're descended from gods and things like that.
Yeah.
And so, not the myth, I don't like to use that word because it's not like other myths in the story. And so that's the idea there. It helps prove Aryan superiority. And so I'm not saying that every single, like, Hitler was not fond of the idea, but it had a lot of cachet at the time.
And, yeah, Hitler criticized Himmler of just finding mud huts and stuff and making them look bad. Yeah.
Which is what basically he would find, right? That's archaeology after all. I've dug a lot of mud huts. But so this was a popular idea, and there was a lot of sort of philosophy and scholarship on this. And it drew on earlier 19th century, very colonial thoughts on this too. Like Blavatsky is a big name in this. And so it has been picked up today on YouTube. there is this YouTuber named Robert Sapere, and I really don't even want anybody to go look up his name or anything about him because he's very nasty. Mm. And he very much clearly yesterday at one point when Atlantis bubbled up, because he has his YouTube channel is called Atlantean Gardens, and he has like 250,000 subscribers and lots of views. And he very commonly will say that scholars are wrong and Nazi scholars are correct on things like Atlantis and other stuff. And he uses
No, that's pretty bad right there.
That's really bad. What did he say yesterday? I have this right here. He says, the scientists that denounce Atlantis that the Nazis took seriously are the same scientists that pushed Piltdown Man as the missing link for the entire first half of the 20th century. Which, yeah, you know, Piltdown, huh?
Yeah, we all know that Piltdown Man isn't true. None of us like believe that. Like, you know, I hate it when they bring that up. Like to
as a gotcha. Like,
yeah, we're like, we know, we agree.
Yeah,
you were wrong
exactly.
Like 100 years ago.
That is a hoax.
Wrong now.
It's a very bad and clear hoax. And yeah, so he uses that. And I mean, another tweet that got deleted yesterday was the eight legs are symbolic, as are the Viking swastikas from the same era, which got me banned from Facebook. Before you say that Hitler ruined the ancient Aryan symbol, consider that it is banned because he actually knew what he was talking about historically. What are they hiding? And so, weirdly enough, there's a swastika emoji that he used. And I don't know how that comes across, but it's really strange. I mean, obviously, these tweets have since been taken down and whatnot. And but he talks about this kind of stuff, connecting direct Nazi scholarship on Atlantis, and that's the theme of his YouTube channel, is Atlantean Gardens.
Well,
and
it's my scientific opinion that this guy should probably get popped in the jaw.
Yeah, Harrison Ford would probably be would agree. and so, you know, to me, this is real problematic because you say that you are putting real archaeologists on TV to discuss pseudo archaeology. I'm not trying to say that the show is saying anything like this. They are not. I do not in any way think that anyone involved on this show, Stel Pavlo or anyone else, is a Nazi. Not at all. But at the same time, if you're thinking that you're inspiring kids to do research and become archaeologists, well, you're also presenting Atlantis as true. And so they're going to start Googling it. They're going to search on YouTube, Atlantis Truth, and they're going to get Graham Hancock. They're going to get a whole array of pseudo-archaeology. And if you just go down that rabbit hole, at the very end is this guy, right? Yeah. And so it's real problematic in my mind to therefore be presenting something like this as the truth. And it's why I am very opposed to things like Ancient Aliens as well, which also has very heavily racist connotations after all, because white people get credit for their great monuments. But if you're have darker skin, no, it's aliens that built your monuments.
Yeah.
And like, if you read like some of von Daniken's like works, it's like, whoa, that's bad.
Oh yeah,
there's some quotes you can find where it's like, yikes.
Very much about the skin, the color of people's skin, and how that affects their civilization. And you know, I mean, like, don't get me wrong, archaeologists from 100 years ago, maybe even 50, maybe not 50, but it's tough to tell. But certainly archaeologists of the 19th and early 20th century had a lot of colonial and white supremacist ideas that we would now consider white supremacists. And so there's a lot of that that pervades early archaeology. And so that's why it's really important to make sure you update with more recent scholarship so that you're not as impacted by that. Right.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there is a way to tell the story that aliens came to Earth a long time ago and helped humans and it not be like racialized, but they don't do it that way. Because they don't focus on like, oh, Rome's democracy was helped because, you know, the Romans couldn't figure out this process, but aliens helped them. You know, like they may say that, but that'll be point like 127 out of 180 point paper. You know, and all the other ones were like, how did the Mexicans build this cool thing? Aliens. And you're like, well, OK, man, that's pretty
just
iffy.
No. Yeah. And then even if you were to do it in like a way that was not racist, I don't know how you could. But even if you were, you're still leading people towards that scholarship, right? Because you're validating it in a sense as a hypothesis. And so you know, it's real problematic in that sense as well.
I kind of feel the same way about like chiropractic care, for example. Like chiropractic care is based upon a pre-scientific idea of sublimations in the body, which, you know, is just nonsense. But some chiropractic people do physical therapy that's real, or massages that are real. And some people are like, oh, well, it's okay to go to them for that. I'm like, yeah, but there's a whole stew there. You know, you're telling me you can pick out the carrots, but I mean, most people aren't going to pick out the carrots. They're going to eat the stew. And the rest of the stew is complete dangerous nonsense.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Just, I mean, and if there's Nazis in the stew, don't eat the stew. You know, I mean, like if you found a maggot in like your bread bag, you just throw the bread away. You're not going to be like, oh, well, let's talk about the merits of keeping the bread. I don't care about that. Just get rid of it.
And I mean, you know, it's funny because like, you know, what's that internet law? Like you never bring out Nazis. But it's like, you know, what else are you supposed to do when you get to Atlantis? Like, that's like literally part of its historiography. I think somebody commented on my thread, wow, that went from zero to Nazi really quickly. And it's just like, well, and you know, when you look at the Plato as well, this is problematic too. I mean, after all, Plato is what undergirds modern eugenics in the 19th century that was developed, right? And so in the Republic, we talked about the Republic earlier, in that he talks about having a state-controlled kind of marriage and procreation program to make sure that it's for the best people. And this was picked up by scholars in the 19th and 20th, early 19th and early 20th centuries that started developing these eugenics philosophies. And so if you look at sort of, it was also picked up, by the way, by the Nazis. So Alan Kim, who wrote An Antique Echo, Plato and the Nazis, he mentions how the Republic is the mythic image of the common Aryan vision of the Staat, projecting the same ideal of total form. And he continues, the Republic gives fodder to an even more extreme view. Not only is the Volk to be kept free of alien blood, its own stock must be improved by a strict eugenic regimen. And that comes directly from their readings of the Republic. And when you go to the Timaeus and you go to the Critias, where these stories of Atlantis are, this kind of eugenic philosophy kind of pervades it. And so at the very beginning of this whole set of dialogues, what they do is they summarize the Republic really briefly, like a quick synopsis on the Republic. And in there, Socrates says, yeah, yesterday we went on to say, didn't we, that the children of good couples were to be brought up, while the children of bad couples were to be quietly sent away to the other parts of the city. And it's like, whoa.
Don't like that.
Yeah, not at all. And then the very end, you mentioned that the Critias, it's really short. It's just, you know, it's about a third of the length of, say, some of his other dialogues. And it just sort of cuts off at the end. And the way it cuts off is Critias is talking, and he's giving a description of these Atlantides and their divine nature, how they're descended from Poseidon and everything like that. And he'd already talked about that sort of their bloodline, right, in ultra depth. The Greeks like to do this. It's really disgusting in our own way. But he's talking about this kind of bloodline of them. And so he mentions that divine nature, it began to fade as a result of constantly being diluted. And so Zeus then, quote, recognized the degenerate state of their fair line and wished to punish them. And that's why he destroyed them. It's because of eugenics, in a sense, right? They had diluted their bloodline. And so you can see how this myth is going to very much be attractive to people that are interested in eugenics and white supremacy and these kind of fairly nasty racist things.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, these kind of bloodline stories are really popular in like the ancient world, but you would they really got brought to a violent forefront with the Third Reich. So
yeah, exactly. And today on that guy's YouTube and.
Yeah, and today
it's just you know, we have this as a problem that we're trying to grapple with, is, you know, racism in our world, whether it's systemic or whether it's overt. Both of those exist, and this is a good example of very overt racism that still somewhat pervades. And
did the creators of the show respond to the like the dangers of the racism allegation, or?
No, not to my public threads about it, because I brought this up in the first thread as well. Because when I first tweeted about the show, before I ever met Stell, I just sort of said, Discovery Channel, why are you putting Atlantis on TV? No real archaeologist looking for it. That's how I discovered Robert Sapere, because he replied to me. And he called me, like, he told me to, I think, go fuck myself. I'd have to find the tweet. But, you know, all kinds of stuff. And And so, oh, here it is. He said, yeah, he said, fuck yourself. He called me a low IQ, overpaid Marxist charlatan. Fuck yourself. That was his first response.
Wow. Wow. So
this guy does not sound good. This.
No. And this is how I discovered who he was. And so,
what does
this
have to do with Marxism?
I have no idea.
I don't think people quite know what Marxism actually is.
I think you're right. And,
so that's how he started. That's how your first interaction.
That's how I first found out who this dude was. Yeah.
Wow.
And so then I blocked him immediately because I did a little research on him and I said, all right, I don't feel like having this guy do much. And so I screenshot him and I mentioned how he was wrong because in the tweet he mentions, what does he say? He says, Herodotus called the Atlantic Sea before Plato was born. Plato did not make up the story as it was Egyptian and the root Atlan comes from the Americas, Maya, etc. You low IQ overpaid Marxist charlatan, right? That was his whole tweet.
And it so kind of reminds me of the Citizen Kane. you what does he say? You
long-faced, overdressed anarchist.
I am not overdressed.
You are too.
Yeah, exactly. I am not low IQ. Not a Marxist. Yeah. But yeah, so in the replies to him, you know, he has all his followers that eat up his stuff. And he mentioned this Atlan word comes from Maya, right? And so someone goes, what does the root Atlan mean? And he goes, Atl is a glyph in Mesoamerican. And so the same person replies, so would Atlas, you know, the Greek god, mean water bearer? And it's like, well, duh, that's exactly where the term Atlantis comes from, is from the Greek god Atlas, right?
Yeah,
not from this Mesoamerican glyph. And so I'm like, you know, your followers have even figured out your false stuff. And so then he tweets out, I block him, and he goes, you tweeted out a big game there, dribble, but you did the right thing. You don't want any part of me. I would have academically spanked your tushy into another dimension.
What? That's getting hot.
You and I both knew it.
So his wife are very similar in their language.
Actually, you know, I'd not thought about this till I put these two together. I am not going to tweet that at her. Please do not let me do that because I just want to take the high road, okay?
Yeah, there's a lot of drama here. I mostly want to focus on the story, but there's a lot of drama.
I'm sorry. I'm never involved in this kind of drama. This is just what happens when you go to pseudo-archaeology, right?
Yeah.
Well, they're very defensive because they feel like it's classist. They feel like there's these people that are in these institutions that won't give them the time of day.
These Marxist liberals,
and there's a lot of that too. I am an outsider, so like I kind of understand some of it. You know, you feel like your intuition, your analysis isn't going to be sufficient enough, and you might feel an ego trip for that. So like, think some of this might be people, you know, responding to that. But the thing is, if you're going to claim something is real that everybody says isn't real, you better fucking bring the goods. And if you are trying to get the authority of science, which they always do by using scientific jargon, but also literally the authority of scientists and bring them onto your show and then not be honest with them. And then when other people try to be like, hey, I don't think what you're doing is right. And, you know, what are your claims? This doesn't seem to work out. If your response to that is to call them like a Marxist cuck or whatever the hell, like, you know, then, you know, what? I'm just definitely not going to be on your side and I'm not interested in empathizing with you anymore.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'd rather have a substantive debate. You know, every single thing I've written on this, I've provided citations to Plato. I provided citations to scholarship. I provided direct quotes and links to where I got it from. And, you know, I mean, that's how I go about my normal day. And I mean, I'm not trying to do this to, I don't know what.
Well, this is your life now. You're on the Atlantis Twitter
drama. I was
trying
to get a TV show. And it's like, what the heck?
They don't make skeptic TV shows, first of all. They just don't make shows for us.
But it's just like, you know, no, I'm actually just trying to do outreach and explain archaeology to the general public and do my own research. And that's actually all I'm really trying to do. And, I don't know if you're going to, but at the same time, if you're going to do this, I'm going to have a response, I guess. Right. And so,
yeah, just, I guess the actual archaeology world too, always feels a little jaded about this because you're like, oh, we found this cool thing. It tells us something about the world and we worked really hard to do it. And everybody who found it, they, you know, spent like 20, 30 years of their life researching this so we could find this new, like, you know, village or artifact or whatever. And they're like, we found the super city run by crystals. And you're like, okay, man, I guess that's cooler than the hut I found, you know?
Well, but you know, the huts we find are really damn cool, right?
Well, yeah, we right. think like, that. Yeah. We think that. But if you want to know something about the past and someone's like, I don't know, like, so like Trey, in our last story, we talked about the really cool obsidian, like Mexican swords, right? We found a new one. That's cool. That's like a 7 out of 10 cool. But like ancient crystal city under the water that was the most advanced is a 10 out of 10 cool. And sure. It's just, you're just not going to be able to compete against that. So it's hard when they're allowed to lie.
Yeah.
And you have to dig in the dirt to find the truth. So you're like muddy and tired and sweaty. And you're like, I found a hut. And they're like fucking crystal blue people from the past, man, right over there. But they're never over there. They keep leading them around the corner, but they keep taking tickets at every toll, every turn of the corner. You know, it's just unfair.
I mean, I think you're onto something. I think that's obviously true. And that's part of the problem in the world we live in. That's all sound bites, right? And so it's like, you need to, if you want to pitch something, you got to pitch it in 10 seconds. You don't have a good, like 20 minutes to explain what's going on. But I mean, you know, I've given a lot of talks to the general public, and I mean, people like what I have to say. I talk about climate change and how people adapt to it in the past because I mostly study ancient foodways. And so my latest paper in Quaternary International was about the end of the Bronze Age and how climate change lines up with this. I published with a climatologist from Uppsala University, Martin Finney. He did all the climate science. And then what I did was I looked at how animal management changed over time and to look whether there's an adaptation to when the climate gets drier. This is a period where these sort of large civilizations and states collapse. And so the next period, the early Iron Age, is a period of villages. It goes from palaces to villages, and writing disappears in Greece, and art disappears. And so sure enough, if you start looking at the animal bones, which is what I look at the trash of the past, but I can see how people are adapting to this climate change. And so, you know, I think
that's a great way to take a historical thing and then like kind of move it to something that's a concern of modern people, because modern people have this existential dread of climate change, but you're like, you know, we're not the only people to ever deal with this. That's a great hook. So
yeah. And that's going to be relevant. Or I have like my sort of like really cool finds. So like I said, I study animal bones. We're really talking the trash of the past. I just enjoy talking about it. And so, you know, when I study animal bones, I find all kinds of weird things. Like the one that I find a lot of in ancient Greece on a lot of different sites is butchered dog. It's really clear that the ancient Greeks ate dog. Not on like a super regular basis, but not on a super rare basis either. Every site I've studied has some butchered dog. And in ancient Athens, classical Athens around the time of Plato, they are butchering enough dog that I can map out these cut marks on bones and show that they're actually butchering them into the same cuts of meat as pigs. And that includes their cheek. They're curing their cheek. So cured pork cheek, like guanciale. And then they have cured, I have a few examples of what I think is cured dog cheek. And so, you know, that's kind of cool, right? That might not be mega city, but it's something that's interesting and that's real.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I find it interesting. And Trey went on a dig in a Polish graveyard a while ago, and he found a giant. So.
No, we don't know. It was, might have been somebody with gigantism. We haven't gotten the stuff yet, but you know,
don't go that far. Be careful with that. There's a lot of weird theories about giants.
I know. That's why I'm teasing him. So
we were joking because I took a picture at the site and I got permission from the site director and all that. And what happened was, I guess how the foreshortening of the image and all that made it look like the head was the skull, because there was a somebody digging in the background with their hand. So it made the skull look like it was like 2 feet long or something like that. And I'm like, oh no, if this picture gets out, people are going to I'm going to see it on websites.
On Reddit.
Talk about Nephilim.
Oh no.
It's opening a Pandora's box a lot of times. Once you do it, you can't really take it back.
And that's those things. There's a perfectly legitimate explanation for it. It has to do with the camera and the way the photograph was accidentally giving that perspective. But as soon as that photograph's out there, they're going to be like, no, this is proof. And,
they're hiding it from us. Yeah.
And that's something that I think is important as well, is this idea that us historians and archaeologists are hiding the truth about the past. And, you know, it's really hard to overcome that. Because, like, if you really want to do what I do, I read ancient Greek, right? I've read a lot of Plato in his original language. And so that's actually quite important for certain types of scholarly arguments, like the type Stella is making, because you really need to go to the original Greek, because translators, they change this slight nuance of things, because, you know, when you move to a different language, you express things in different ways, and you need to translate it into some way that's readable. And so you sometimes elide a detail or add a slight detail that you're not meaning to add. For various reasons, Emily Wilson, she translated the Odyssey. She's written a lot on this, about the various challenges of translation. And so, you know, like, I know ancient Greek, I teach Latin, I know animal bones, I map out sites digitally, and on top of it, I do scholarship. And so it's not so easy to just jump in and do this. And that's why it seems like it's, like we're gatekeeping, I guess. And I don't want to gatekeep. I want this to be accessible to everybody, which is why I go online and try to share archaeology. But it's just it's hard to engage, and it takes that kind of time to learn these different skills and knowledge sets, I guess, if you're going to really put together archaeology, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, we had Sharon A. Hill on the last podcast, and we were talking about this gatekeeping problem. And I personally feel like science basically has to gatekeep, and it doesn't really have a choice. And it's a problem, but there needs to be a finesse solution around it. Cause I mean, you can't just let everybody in, because it's not about everyone's opinion. It's about the right opinion. So,
right.
I mean, you know, it's tough when you're dealing with the past. I mean, this is why it's tough when you do something like archaeology, cause and history in particular, cause a lot of hypotheses are not really testable. Right.
Yeah, that's definitely
you might
true.
Make a, you, they might be testable, but that depends on the next 100 years of excavation finding something, right? And so maybe not in your lifetime. And so I don't really have a problem with amateurs getting involved. There's plenty of opportunities to go on excavations, oftentimes to local projects or even abroad. I've certainly worked with plenty of amateurs that have gotten involved on projects and excavated right alongside me. And at the same time, in the online sphere, there are plenty of amateurs that, you know, they follow scholars and they engage with scholars in a very good way. I don't want to – good's the wrong term. But in a polite way, and in a way where they're trying to learn. And then they start actually getting in on the conversation. And they do it in a very – in the correct way. And so I think there is room for amateur engagement and potentially even – amateurs that actually sort of end up becoming archaeologists. There are stories of that as well. They might never have the degree. Oftentimes this is somebody that's more wealthy because they have connections and time after they retire. But they will then just jump full in. They never get the degree, but they end up becoming scholars in their own right. And so, you know, there's certainly room for that, but it takes doing it with I don't want to say humble way, because that's.
Just, I would say I think humility is fine. I think it's good to be humble about your own knowledge, especially in pursuit of like these echoes from the past. You know, it's not easy to understand things that happened hundreds and hundreds of years ago, nevertheless thousands of years ago, in cultures which you're not part of. You know,
We have to be that way too. An excavation relies on a million different specialists. I'm there to study the animal bones and sometimes do digital mapping. Someone else is there to study the architecture. Someone else to study the ceramics. Someone else to study the geology. Someone else to study, you know, the human remains, if there's human remains. And if there's pottery, we might have a specialist that just focuses on the late Roman period, the middle Roman, a different one for the early Roman period, a different one for the classical Greek period. And we're finding all this in one trench, right? And so because it's so specialized knowledge, so we need to know our humility as well in that sense. And we, the best archaeologists acknowledge what they don't know is what, and they know who to go to, right? To help them continue with the answer to these questions they might have.
I definitely agree with that. That's exactly right.
So Atlantis, eh?
I think it's basically like the Star Wars prequels are basically a parable about how a good government can go bad, right? And so Coruscant is like the city where this is set at. I don't think Atlantis is any really different than that at all. Trying to find Atlantis is, I think, exactly the same as trying to find Coruscant.
Yeah, like, or Plato's Cave, you know?
Yeah, I mentioned the show. no, I mentioned I on the show agree. Before, if a Plato's cave had a name, there would be history channels about finding it. It was called like the cave of Metallius or something. People would be like, Metallius was a real cave. You know, like that is the only reason. There's no name. So it's a metaphor. But,
oh, and
you know,
I guarantee there'd be a cave already in Greece somewhere named after that.
Oh, yeah. We got like 50 caves.
Early archaeologists would have named it. There probably would be like three of them.
Yeah. I mean, we got like 50 caves where Jesus hung out at and everything, you know, like it. You just claim it. Just claim it and then take tickets.
And early archaeologists did a lot of that. Nestor's Cave, for example, is a cave I'm thinking of. I excavated it at Pylos, what's called the Palace of Nestor. Who knows if the Nestor, if he's real or not, it's a myth, right?
King Priam's treasure and mask of Agamemnon. Schliemann was just like, yeah, that's it, right?
Yeah, and it's just that the early archaeologists did a lot of that. We don't really do that anymore, of course.
Schliemann is the Celio Kant of archaeology. Like, in cryptozoology, you know, they always bring up the Celio Kant to, like, prove that there are animals that people thought were extinct. Mm-hmm. And for archaeology, it seems like the fact that one guy was a huckster, used TNT to find Troy, they're like, well, I can find Atlantis. I mean, like,
well, and exactly, because he was also an amateur. And so he was going against the establishment. And so therefore, they think that they're Schliemann, right?
Yeah.
And they probably have similar ethics sometimes. And so,
yeah. You know, he's a great character. I don't know about being a great person.
I think what's funny is that, like, if we were to ever, like, whenever you find, like, a something in archaeology and you claim that it's, like, this historical figure or whatever, there's, like, so much debate and sort of evaluation on, like, all sides on if it actually is them. I think of Akhenaten, like, the mummy that's allegedly him, and how, like, there's so much debate. And still to this day, we still don't really, there's not a consensus.
Philip II or Alexander's grave and things like that. It's just,
Trey's all about Alexander's grave.
Man. That's
an upcoming video.
I'm not a fan of that kind of archaeology personally. There's some good scholars that sort of work on it tangentially, but
well, at least Alexander's grave is something we got to be able to find it, right? It's a real thing. It would have been a nice grave, right? You'd think.
I mean, Ptolemy stole his body, right? So to give him. To take him to Egypt so that Ptolemy could rule Egypt, because oftentimes you claim power by being the one that buries the predecessor. That's a big symbol, after all. That's why people would bury lots of gold with things. It's a symbol of not necessarily the person that's being buried, but who's doing the burying, right?
That's why the Jedi burn each other.
That's like Virginia, the tombs there. Where like there's a lot of debate on if there was Philip II or Philip III, and I still don't know if there's actually an answer to it.
No,
and that they were. Oh yeah, you can.
Yeah, these kind of things I find personally I find these things to be fruitless. And I think most archaeologists agree with me, but obviously there are some archaeologists that still go for this kind of stuff.
It grabs the headlines definitely, but
it does. Yeah. It does.
It's romantic stuff, but like I said, like there's still romantic things that are real. So it's a shame that like this is the stuff we're just stuck with.
I mean, I was field director at the Palace of Nestor at Pylos in 2015, and the first day of work, we were digging in this hill where we didn't know what we find, and we were looking for the lower town actually, and that was the idea there, and. We were clearing off all the grass, and the trench supervisor, Ali Fields, a really awesome archaeology student who unfortunately is no longer in the field, she comes to me and she says, look, Flint, we got to put a trench here because these three stones that we found poking up out of the grass make a corner. And lo and behold, it became one of the wealthiest finds ever in Greece in like the last 50 years. It's called the Tomb of the Griffin Warrior. And, you know, it made the news. I was quoted in the Smithsonian Magazine for it and, like, junk like that. There was actually just an episode a few days ago on Smithsonian Channel. I'm no longer involved on the project. But, you know, so sometimes we do find these very romantic, glorious things. It was a very wealthy find, right?
Yeah. Well, it has a good name, too. That's a good
name. Well, that was the director's choice.
Well, I think it's important. I feel like in astronomy they mess up sometimes. They, like, find a new planet that's, like, super awesome. You know, it has like golden mountains and like flowing methane lakes and it's super cool. And they name it like K12 T11. I'm like, guys, this is not how you tell people that science and discovery is cool. Like, people are going to go try to find Bigfoot because he's named Bigfoot. They're not going to care about KT111. They're just not. Like,
yeah, and I think
this is why we need more humanities people in SciComm. You know, it's like, let us help you guys out a bit.
And I mean, I'm all for some level of sensationalizing, but I also think, as we see with something like Atlantis, you need to be careful. And
oh, so yeah, Atlantis is complete bunk all the way every day. So
you have to find a happy medium, I guess, is the right way to put it. A way that's not going to lead people astray, but at the same time will actually excite their imaginations, right? And so it's a lot about how you paint that picture anyway. And so I think that storytelling is important in that sense, right?
Mm. Yeah, because we're all trying to combat Graham Hancock. It's like him and Ancient Aliens are like the voice for archaeology right now to the general public. And that's, I think, really disappointing.
Yeah, it's really a big
problem. Oh my God, Miles, you're right. I didn't realize that.
It's very true.
Like, if you are like 10 years old and you don't like have a peer group that knows about archaeology and you want to learn about archaeology, your sources for this are Graham Hancock and Ancient Aliens. That's what you're going to find. That's the surface level.
And island stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, God.
And this is a problem. Like, this is why I want to have these conversations. You know, I think Atlantis is interesting as a tool to think about where we go wrong and where we mess up more than where is it? Because, you know, it just obviously doesn't exist.
And use it as a jumping off point. I'm hoping to do a YouTube video with Stefan Milo and Anna Goldfield on this topic. And what the goal will be to actually use this as a jumping off point to present real archaeology of this period and not try to claim Atlantis is real, but to use that to then say, all right, let's think about how Plato describes Athens at that time. There were certain things from the past that he could see, right? He could see the Acropolis wall that was built, 600, 700 years before him. He could see the ruins of the temple that the Persians destroyed 200 years earlier to Athena that was on the Acropolis, and he describes these things. And, you know, they're all a mishmash because one's from 1200 BC, the other's from 650 BC, and then the other's from 500 BC this spring. And he gets the geology all wrong, but it's kind of interesting that he takes stuff that he could see and interweaves that into the story, right? These ruins that were, there were ruins in his time. And they were very visible because the Athenians purposely kept the ruins of that temple exposed to memorialize the Persian destruction of Athens, right? And so it's still there today. You go on Google Earth and you zoom in on the Athenian Acropolis, right next to the Parthenon, in between the Parthenon and the Erechtheion, which the Greeks have reconstructed into these beautiful, mostly whole-looking temples, you see the outlines of this structure, and that is the ruins of the Temple of Athena that were left there intentionally by the Athenians in 500 BC or 490 BC and have been there ever since, untouched and undisturbed in a sense and unbuilt over as a memorial. Wow. And so, you know, that's kind of cool that he's weaving that in. And it's kind of cool that you could go on Google Earth and do that right now. So if you're listening, go do that.
Nice.
Well, I want to thank you for coming on and kind of dishing about your dish, I guess.
Thanks.
Yeah. You know, you don't get a lot of kind of like high impact dramatic archaeology moments on Twitter. So I figured, you know, we should probably cover this one.
That's weird.
Yeah. You know, like I try not to be like a drama show. But, you know, I think this is worth covering. And it's always good to talk about these topics and kind of why we have a problem with them. Because if you are kind of new to the thing, you're like, well, why do you guys care so much if it's real or not? You know, like it's the question that skeptics normally get, you know, what's the harm? It's like, well, there's a lot of harm.
Yeah.
You know, these things don't just exist passively. So.
No, I agree. I agree. And I want to say for the record that I do not usually deal with this kind of drama either. And if you do follow me on Twitter, you'll see that most of my threads are just presenting real archaeology in what I hope is a fun way. And so, you know, teaching how we do it and teaching about the kinds of questions we ask and the kinds of evidence we have and the, you know, the methods we use. And so, yeah, this was a weird weekend for me.
Yeah.
I'm really
well,
glad.
Thanks.
Thank you for inviting me. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And thanks for coming on a short notice. We really appreciate it. Where can people find your stuff if they want to check out your work?
Like my research is right now on my – I'm going to have an academic site at Cardiff soon. I can send you that link to add to it. Would that work?
I think
my Dartmouth website's still up. But
And your Twitter?
My Twitter. Go to my Twitter. Flint Dibble is my handle. That's okay. Where I do my outreach. And I definitely will always, every time I publish an article, write a Twitter thread summarizing it so that the public knows. And if anybody ever wants an article of mine, if it's behind a paywall, always send me an email. Scholars are happy to share PDFs. We want people to read what we've published. And I will always provide as many links as possible to things that are open.
Awesome. Well, thanks for coming on the show. We really appreciated having you.
Yeah, thank you both, you so Trey and Miles. Yeah, I really appreciate it.
Well, that was a really great interview, Trey. I had a fun time listening to that.
Yeah, me too.
And I did like it quite a bit, but there's one thing I like even more.
Oh, what's that? What's that?
Monster Quest.
Monster Quest.
Head start.
Witnesses around the world report seeing monsters. Are they real or imaginary? Science searches for answers on Monster Quest.
Okay, Trey, so we're on the search of something this time that's a little unusual.
Yes, it is a little weird. It's one of like the more, I don't even say this, unique cryptids out there.
Yeah, I mean, is it a cryptid? I mean, are they...
It's debatable if it's even a cryptid. Yeah. It's and it's very strange looking. It's more like an
optical phenomenon. I guess there are three hypotheses of what this thing could be, and I think one of them is a cryptid.
Yeah.
The other two aren't. So that's the kind of thing we're working for. Okay. And what is it? What is this thing, Trey?
This thing is what did they call it in the episode? Unidentified flying object or creature or something like that. Anyway, it's the rods. It's
the name of the episode is Unidentified Flying Creature, also known as a rod.
Mm-hmm. And rods are this kind of weird optical phenomena where people started noticing it more probably from like the 90s to early 2000s on, where it's like people would take these videos, like home videos or of any literally anything, and then find like these creatures, quote unquote creatures, zipping by really, really quickly in the background.
So we have this man named Jose.
Yes.
And he was a UFO researcher, and he went out to Roswell because people believe in a conspiracy that the CIA created that they were aliens so that people wouldn't believe that their weather balloons were real. And people believe the conspiracy about the conspiracy. And so he was out there looking for these UFOs, and then he got in his camera this weird cylindrical shaped thing that has like possible rotating wings around it or maybe a membrane. And then he called them rods.
Rods. And that's, is that where it sort of stuck?
So basically he's the guy. He's like the Patterson Gimlin of rods.
He's the rod master.
Yeah. He's the rod master. Yeah. that they can be between 1 to 6 feet long, which is quite a range.
Yeah, I've heard them even larger than that. I've heard like these sort of skyfish ones where they're like bus sized and stuff, which is a little bit more ridiculous.
Yeah, we get this with some of these cryptids. They like mention a size, but then they like will bring up a sighting that doesn't fit within the range, but they just use it, you know. Like skunk ape. They're like, oh, it's this tall, but then there's an 8-foot sighting thing, and we'll count that. I'm like, you specific, like, okay, man, like, you told me it was five.
There was the 13-foot tall one with skunk ape. It was,
oh, yeah, well, that story did happen. I believe in that. I just don't believe it was a skunk ape. There's
the
definitely
Oki
an ogre
creature.
Yeah, that I believe in, but, so these things are basically like missiles or skyfish or aliens or perhaps interdimensional creatures is one of the hypotheses.
It's possible. Yeah, the phasing in and out of the universe thing.
Yes. So they even quote this one person who says, is it possible for beings to cross between dimensions? Theoretically, yes. And I was like, I love theoretically, yes, because you can just say that.
You could say that.
Is it true that Bigfoot and aliens play Magic the Gathering together on Fridays while eating enchiladas? Theoretically, yes. You know, like, and I mean, it's a completely logical sentence.
Yeah, yeah. Does Atlantis exist? Theoretically, yes.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So this also kind of became more popular on October 20th, 2002. A Fox News covered a story where this news video camera guy named Brandon Mohert, he recorded a rod. And this was in 2002. So if you're younger, you have to remember this was not too long after 9/11. Yeah. And there was a lot of paranoia in this country at the time. People were just doing all this kind of doomsday prepping, and there was fears about like remote control airplanes and everything, like anything that could fly. People were scared of and it's easy to look back and make fun of it, but 9/11 was really scary if you were there at the time, because you know one plane hit the World Trade Center, then a second, and then one hit the Pentagon, and one almost hit the White House. It was taken down. But, yeah. You know, it just came out of nowhere and we didn't really know what was happening. And so this person saw this rod and was, of course, you know, concerned about it in this era of paranoia. So he brought the rod to the airport security, and the security team had no idea what this rod thing was. So he called it the FBI, and then a Fox Mulder came and took it away from him, and he lost the tape.
Yeah, some G-man took it, apparently.
Yeah, so, you know, like, sure, the FBI, they're fine to confiscate a tape of an unknown aerial phenomenon near an airport at the time. That seems like a reasonable thing for them to do, really.
But it seemed like I guess we'll get into this in a second, but, like, it seemed like they have the tape still. So was there a copy, I guess? Or
yeah, I guess so. Because they show you the tape, right? So
how careless of the FBI to not take both copies.
Yeah, I don't know if the FBI was concerned on the taking more than the having. So if you had a copy, that's totally fine. And then in 1999, Monster Quest tells us that there was a rod captured the midst of an extreme tornado event. And there's a meteorologist who found it, and he was very puzzled by the fact that there would be a rod near a tornado, and seemed to suggest some kind of meaning to this coincidence. Like, why would a rod be a tornado? Like, what is it up to?
Well, that's when they brought up the phasing in and out of dimensions, I think.
Yeah, that was brought up. And so Jose Escamilla is interviewed several times here when they're kind of setting up the rod, because he's basically the guy. He goes around and gave talks on this. He has since passed away, but this was kind of his life's work, trying to build up this rod phenomenon. And a bunch of these sightings, when we go to our search section, will be ones that he basically called the people that initiated the identification of them being rods. Okay, now we know what rods are, I guess. They're kind of undefined, aren't they?
They're really in this sort of vague area where they don't talk about if they're they're physical, like animals, like if like they're a type of like insect or something like that, or if they're like something from another dimension or aliens. It's very, very broad. It can be anything you want it to be.
Yeah. So at this point we have unknown insect, unknown bird, missile, or
terrorist weapon or something.
Yeah. Or interdimensional entity of some sort.
Yes.
Or alien.
Or that's, yeah. Always so, alien is not.
So basically a long, thin cylindrical shape that appears to have multiple wings, or maybe a wing membrane. So like a flappy, like piece of cloth that flows, if that helps you visualize it. Thing, I guess that's what we're on the search for.
Yeah.
And so who do we go to first to help us find this undefinable thing?
So we go to Thomas Branchov.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Brown University. And he's the quote where it says it's possible theoretically that this is something like jumping between dimensions, but he's kind of like, I think he's just talking to the camera.
it's hard to tell, because sometimes these guys say things that I think are a bit outlandish, but I don't know what question they were asked. You know?
Right. This episode had it a lot more than some other ones, where I didn't know how aware some of the people that they're interviewing knew what they're being interviewing for, you know, like if like they knew that they're being interviewed for rods as opposed to like something on I don't know,
the history of insects or whatever,
right? History of insects or evolution or like engineering sort of design. I don't know. It's weird. It's kind of cut up in some areas.
Yeah. And then we go to Iowa State University and we meet a Dr. Wu.
And he and I think a team of grad students were going to do an experiment on If a if two separate designs of what like the rod shape is speculated to be could actually fly, in like a
yeah, he has a great quote where he says any shape can fly with enough power. Or he's basically like, you could chuck anything, like you just throw it and it will fly. Like, I mean, you just got to throw it really hard, which is true. You know, that's true.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, they built a few of these alleged rod shapes, right? They build a rigid one and a soft one, one with the multiple wings, and then one with a membrane. One with a missile shape, and then one with the membrane.
Yeah, one with the membrane, and then one that had like it was like a thin membrane, and then one that had stiff rigid wings.
Yeah,
like a sort of series of them, and they're going to test them.
Then they put them in the wind tunnel and they're going to check out and see if, you know, these shapes are even plausible to fly at all.
Right. Right.
Yep. And then we go back to Jose. And Jose shows us a photo from 1957.
Yep.
That he says is a rod and shows that, you know, these have existed before modern cameras. However, the photo looks nothing like a rod.
Well, that's the thing is rods. It seems like rods could just be whatever you want them to be because it's such a simple shape in photos. What there is. There's a lot of variation in their shape and size. And sometimes they have four pairs of wings. Sometimes they have like seven pairs of wings or something crazy like that.
Yeah. So Monster Quest mentions that one of the critical, you know, the skeptical opinions on these are this is an artifact from the photography itself. Right.
Yeah.
Jose here tries to bring up the idea that this can't be the case because of this photo from 1957, but this photo just shows like a white blurry thing that's like a half oval.
That was the one that looked like a UFO. If you told me what
weird paranormal thing would be, I'd be like, yeah, that's an alien, I guess. You know, you're trying to tell me.
Right. I saw that. And I remember explicitly going like trying to go, that doesn't look like a rod. Like I know what rods look like. And that looks more like a UFO flying saucer picture than a rod.
Yeah. Like in my notes for the show, I try to be kind of nice and just say what they said. But I was just like, man, that's not a fucking rod. I mean, come on, bro. Like, and then they do a little bit of like fake archaeology.
I saw this. I remember watching this as a kid, and I remember this segment in particular convincing me where it was like, so they have these 1,000-year-old Argentinian cave doodles or rock art doodles, and one of the doodles looks like a stick with the little squiggly lines around it, which they say looks like a rod, and it's evidence that prehistoric humans or ancient humans saw rods and depicted them.
Yeah, big doubt.
Well, because then they bring up this I forgot the guy's name. He was an anthropologist, and they talked to him
Dr. Cursini from Southern Illinois University. Yes.
Yeah, that's him. Where he talks about how humans in the past had way better eyesight or something.
His argument was that literate people develop less, like by literate, I mean people who like read things in like their local area, right? So like you're reading, you're looking at screens, looking at stuff like that's close to you, manipulating that, you get less perception of your environment around you.
Yeah. Which I can see the logic in that, but I think Monster Quest is extending it way too far where they're saying that like people in prehistory had such good eyes that they could see like these rods that travel faster than like that can only be visible in high frame rate cameras or something like that. It's a little bit of a,
and my anecdotal experience, you know, like I used to go hunting a good amount with my dad, you know, I'm pretty good at like picking out deer or movement on the tree line. Right. And like some people I know are not very good at that. And so I don't know if that the skill or had anything to do with my upbringing. I don't know if people in the past are better. Perhaps there's research on this that knows for sure. He claims it, but I just don't know that much about if this is true or not. But even if it is, I mean, the ability to see a rod seems at the distance they claim and other times that they're going doesn't seem very true.
Yeah, I don't think so either. And this part had my favorite Monster Quest piece of evidence was the gorilla in the Minnesota Zoo.
Yep, it's in a Minnesota. basically there's a gorilla and he's hanging out, you know, doing what gorillas do.
He's
and then
like a leaf and he's
and then allegedly a rod flies by And he side-eyes that shit.
And he looks, like, yeah, he looks up slightly annoyed.
And they're like, oh, well, gorillas can see rods, so obviously ancient humans could see rods. Look, that's their argument.
Gorilla responded to rod flying over. Therefore, ancient humans could do it too. It's like, what? I think that's a bit of a, I don't know. That was a weird clip.
It's interesting. So yeah, I mean, like, the video does show a what they're calling a rod flyby. It's a smaller cylindrical thing with like a membrane of wings going by. So like, yeah, there is that video. Well, that's a real thing. They then do one of my favorite things Monster Quest does. They do a reenactment.
Yes, yes. This was also one of my favorite parts of the episode.
Take us back to 1891, Trey.
Okay, and Miles, you're going to love this. On this day, we didn't even know about this. This event happened on this day, September 5th.
Wait, what?
Yeah. So the Crawfordville Monster in 1891 appeared on September 5th, 130 years ago to the day that we're recording this.
Well, happy anniversary to all those who celebrate.
I remember I saw it last night. I was like, wait a second, September 5th, that's tomorrow. That's when me and Miles are recording. So that's it. So this, in 1891, these two Icemen.
Icemen, they call them.
Icemen, these guys who, I guess back in the olden days, the guys delivered ice to your door in the middle of the night. They at 2 a.m. in this small town, Crawfordville, Illinois, right?
Indiana.
Oh crap, I mixed them up to both eyes. Indiana. They're looking and they look up in the sky and they're like, whoa, Jovo, look at that. That's a creature up there. And it was a long, like snake-like white creature with no head and no tail and like a whole bunch of series of wings flying around in the sky.
In my Monster Quest voice, and to quote the show, it was,
yes,
a seemingly headless monster about 20 feet long and 8 foot wide, with no head nor tail, propelled by fin-like attachments.
Yes. Yeah, it was a sky monster, almost like a Lovecraftian sounding creature.
Absolutely it was. And man, it's so beautiful, and I wish that it would come and take us all.
Well, it's one of the more creative. So this is known, I think, now as the Crawfordville Monster,
mm-hmm.
And it's one of the more obscure cryptids, but one of the most interesting ones because it's like a literal Lovecraftian monster before Lovecraft even was like writing his books. I feel like, and it's yeah, it's this weird. I think in other stories or in the original report, they say that it had like a flaming eye.
Oh, what the hell are these guys seeing? What the heck happened here?
and we can get in this later, but the story has been all, we'll get into, it's kind of like the Okefenokee yeah, monster, where like the original,
which I believe
story,
in and is true, I'm gonna choose to believe in this one too, so.
Where like what the original news report said and what has been repeated by rod enthusiasts, I guess, it's very different. There's one at least Monster Quest got this version of the story right, where it was just two guys at 2 a.m. There's an alternate version, which I don't know where it originates from, but it's repeated often, is that the whole town saw the monster in broad daylight.
Wow.
And it was like moaning in agony and breathing on them and stuff, and they could feel its hot breath. But that's not in the original news story. That's a later edition.
It was probably just an owl.
Well, we do. Should I say?
Okay, we'll get to this in the findings.
I'm getting too excited.
Yeah. Oh, I'm excited. This is the anniversary of the Crawfordsville, Indiana Sky Monster, buddy. This is an important day.
130 years to the day. Man,
I mean, it feels good to be alive on this the day of our Lord, the Sky Monster. Okay, so yeah. other than the awesome reenactment, which we always love, mm-hmm. we go down to Mexico to the Cave of the Swallows,
yes,
and we meet an extreme cameraman and base jumper, and he recorded a whole bunch of videos of him and his mate free diving. Right, they basically are people who will die from falls jumping into a giant pit, mm-hmm. but because of parachutes they live. Very scary. I would not do this. Seems foolish.
I liked how when Monster Quest the episode opened, they opened like before the intro, it just showed one of the guys jumping in screaming.
Yeah.
And then just cut to the intro and it's like, whoa, what happened there?
The rod killed him.
Yeah, did he die for Monster Quest?
So this video aired on TV, apparently, these people jumping.
Yeah.
I don't know on what. I didn't look that up because I'm lazy. But basically, Jose saw this tape and then got in contact with his people and told them that they were rods in their tape. Mm-hmm. Okay. So because basically, like, you can see when they're jumping, there's like a lot of birds, and because it's, you know, the Cave of the Swallows, right? And yeah. and bugs, because that's what birds eat, like around this cave. But Jose calls them and says, oh my god, there's rods on your tape. And so the people go, oh yeah, sure there are, those are rods. And they like believe this guy's story about rods and how they're not bugs or birds. Yeah. So Mark Lachell, the base jumper himself, he mentioned that, you know, he saw a lot of bugs, he saw a lot of birds, but he did not see any rods himself.
Well, when we first went to the cave on the first few trips, we did not see rods. We did not know what rods were. We were just down there doing our jumping and filming.
So while he was there until Jose, the rod master, called him and told him that he found rods. So.
Right. And then
what's the next piece of evidence that we find?
The next piece of evidence was this very enigmatic. They called it the Chinese tape or whatever.
Yeah, it's like an alien autopsy tape name, or like, you know, it's okay. You know what I'm talking about?
It was this weird cave with a man, and we don't get a name. We don't get an interview. Oh, we get a date, maybe.
Yep, 2005,
and. No, not the cave's name, not the region this was filmed in, not anything else. It's like literally just China 2005 in a cave somewhere. And he's walking in, this older gentleman, and a rod flies by his head and goes into the cave.
In a swooping maneuver instead of the straight on shot that the rods are typically shown in.
So. Yes.
So, yeah, there's that, and they bring that up. So... That's all they really say about that at the moment.
Yeah.
And then we go talk to Robin Wooten of the University of Exeter in the UK. And he's an expert on like bug evolution and extinct bugs and stuff like that.
Yeah. And he claims that his hypothetical transitional form between sort of wingless arthropods and then ones that could fly, he calls it the proto-pterygoat. Proto something like that. And he posits that it looked a lot like a rod, but probably couldn't fly that far. It existed during the Carboniferous at some time, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, 320 million years ago.
Yeah. And as far as I can tell, I tried to look up, it does not seem like his hypothetical model is the extant model anymore.
So yeah, it was interesting. He basically like proposed like this rod as some kind of proto insect shape. And then they kind of asked him like, would it have still existed, you know, without evolving over all this time? And he basically said probably not, but he called it a transitional species, which I thought was kind of strange. Because that's kind of like an archaic way to think about it, isn't it? Like,
yeah, because in fossils, everything's a transitional.
Yeah, and transition fossil. From what to what, you know, like.
Yeah.
He says the first bugs probably looked like rods, as demonstrated by this flyable model.
The origin of insect flight was probably about 360 million years ago. Proto-pterygoat is a name which is being given to a kind of hypothetical ancestor of the winged insects. So these things would be gliding, using the movable winglets to stabilize their fall.
But there is a problem with the proto-pterygoat theory.
I think it's extremely unlikely that proto-pterygoats would survive for any length of time because these are transitional forms. They're not very good at flight. They would need to be in very isolated, very strange conditions not to have become extinct.
Like you can see like morphologies kind of like take forms and stay in that form for a while. So I guess if you're looking at a long time scale, you might say that at any moment, something seems to be transitioning, but the transitional fossil phrase is kind of like linked to this like missing link kind of misunderstanding of evolution, you know? Mm. So like, I thought it was a bit strange to hear those terms in a supposed science show, you know?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I guess they were just trying to make it obvious that like he would expect the wings to develop more through selective pressure over time and not be so kind of mundane for that long. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, I think his theory is that that the early arthropods used a sort of series of these there's two competing theories that it's gill extensions or like armor plating extensions as like a gliding from like tree branch to tree branch, like almost like ground squirrels.
Yeah, sure. Maybe
not ground squirrels, flying squirrels.
Yeah.
It's in the
yeah,
name.
The opposite of that.
The opposite of that. And I think he says like over a series of time, that sort of system of flying would be ruled out as sort of impractical and replaced with the more complex types of wings. Yeah.
Sure. Maybe.
Yeah, I, as far as I can tell, it doesn't seem like his hypothetical model is still the predominant one, as far as I can tell. Because I think we found since this time more transitional fossils of like early flying insects, and they don't really resemble this.
So let's go to our findings, Trey.
Yes.
What did we get from the wind tunnel? How did that work out?
It didn't work out that well.
Dang.
It seems like so the flexible rod one, the one with the wing membrane, was very unstable and couldn't lift well at all. It couldn't fly. They said it was a very bad model.
Not crap. Good. Yeah.
And then they said that the rigid one, the one with the multiple stiff wings, as opposed to the single membrane, was stable, but it wasn't really that good. Like it could fly a little bit, but it was
Hunk of junk.
Yeah, it was not like the optimal flying model, and it's probably towards the lower end.
What a piece of junk!
She'll make 0.5 past light speed. She may not look like much, but she's got it where it counts, kid. I've made a lot of special modifications myself.
So both findings found that the rod sort of shape isn't that practical.
Yeah, so the Wu mentions that, you know, it could possibly fly, but it would need an extreme amount of energy to propel it because it's a heavy amount of drag and low amount of lift. So basically not something that nature would allow for as a flying entity. So I guess that doesn't rule out interdimensional power sources.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Because they bring up Flatland. Do you ever read Flatland?
I have not read Flatland, no, but they do bring it up.
I watched, there's a movie on YouTube. It's like really bad for Flatland. It's like really poorly animated or really primitive animation. And it's beautiful. It's gorgeous.
Imagine a vast plain, a world of only two dimensions on which triangles, squares, pentagons, and other figures live and move freely about.
And it looks like those bowling animations when you get a strike.
So you want to explain what Flatland is a bit?
Flatland, it was is H.G. Wells who wrote the original story?
I don't even know.
I don't think. No, they bring up H.G. Wells because they talk about the time machine.
About time machine for some fucking reason.
It was like the Killer Ape Man one, like where they're like
King Kong.
Let me see who Flatland author.
Jose actually brings up science fiction like tropes to bolster his argument. And I'm like, how was that relevant, dude? I just don't understand.
Edwin Abbott is the original writer of Flatland. Anyways, okay. It was a thought exercise on like what it would be like for a being from one dimension going into another. So you have like, so it has these two dimensional creatures living on like the surface of a pond. They're flat like pieces of paper. Mm-hmm. And at one point a sphere like a three-dimensional sphere goes into their world and they just can't interpret it. It's just beyond their imagination to picture a three-dimensional object because he's phasing through their world in and out whenever he dips in, dips out.
Sure.
And all they see is just a single or the two dimensions of him along that line, along the plane of their existence. And what Monster Quest is trying to say is that the rods are like so we're three-dimensional and some four-dimensional creatures going in into our universe and popping in and out and
that
kind of thing.
Which, you know, like I guess physics allows for that possibly, but there's absolutely no reason to think that that's an explanation for this phenomenon at this time. So.
Right. There's no evidence to back this up. And when you're pointing to a science fiction story from like the, when was it written, the 1800s or something, 1880 something. It's like, that's your evidence. It's kind of weak.
If this was made today, they would have said quantum about 25 times.
They would have, yeah, they would have like said, this is the quantum realm jumping in and out. This is the Schrodinger's cat.
Oh,
in the Middle Ages, healers would conjure up evil spirits or magical spells. Now in the 21st century, it seems they turn to black holes and above all, quantum physics. Quantum theory accounts for the anomalous behavior of light and atoms. It's astonishingly accurate, but notoriously difficult to grasp.
Quantum healing is a theory that a shift in consciousness creates a shift in biology. That's it. We try and get into every aspect of a patient's life, their relationships, their hopes, their dreams, and then we combine it with a ritual of deep meditation, massage, and really a lot of spiritual counseling, including the fear of death. We think that many times patients feel healed even though they may die from a disease if they learn to go beyond their personal fear of death. And you can never do that unless you have a patient have a spiritual experience.
Where did the quantum theory come into that?
Oh, it's just a metaphor, just like an electron or a photon.
Sorry for the aside, but I just had to play that because whenever I think about quantum theory, I always think of the It's a Metaphor by Deepak Chopra, and I found it too funny, so I just wanted to share it. All right, back to the show. So then we go on an actually pretty good fact-finding mission. We get a high-speed camera expert, Peter Switz, and he sets up two different cameras.
Yep.
One on normal speed and one is a high-speed camera.
They have the clock set up so they can time them correctly to each other. I think this was a very great experiment. This is a perfect little experiment right here.
Yeah, and high-speed cameras are awesome. Of course, you can go on YouTube and watch high-speeds, like stuff break or whatever. You can see a glass, you know, get thrown at the wall and see what it looks like. And it actually can help us understand things about physics or material properties because there's like non-intuitive ways that things happen, like when they get destroyed or affected by large amounts of energy, that you can really see in these high-speed cameras. So they're pretty cool technology.
Yeah, I agree.
And they've only gotten better through the years. So.
Right. That's the thing is I wonder if rod sightings have gone down since camera quality has been getting better.
Yeah, I was actually wondering that too. We'll comment on that in just a second.
Oh, yeah.
So he sets up his cameras, and then we go back to talk to some ornithologists.
Yes, and examine the China cave rod. The China tape. The China tape.
Yeah. So they examine it and they think that it could be a bird, maybe. They're like, I guess it could be a hummingbird. And then they like kind of play up the fact that like it shouldn't be a hummingbird.
Yeah.
But then they're like, actually, we think it's an insect, though.
Yeah. And it probably was. It's like when you have these really blurry footage, it's like, what do you even say?
I mean, it's an insect.
Yeah.
Well, I'd say that's just an insect. No. So that's what they say about that. They basically put the China tape doesn't really amount to anything.
The China tape.
Yeah. And so then we go back to Dr. Wu, and Dr. Wu has the opinion that they're probably created by the camera.
Yeah. Which I think his explanation of it with like the double images, I think is perfect.
Yeah, so and interlacing causes this as well. You know, if you get like 1080p or 1080i, right? Mm-hmm. So like P is progressive scan and I is interlace. And interlace means that it doesn't always write a whole new image every time it writes an image. It takes some information from the previous image and leaves it there because it doesn't like need to make the image look resolvable, right?
Right.
And so some of this could be a phenomenon of the interlacing technology. Also, just the way cameras work, you know, the shutter speeds aren't high enough, so there's always an amount of motion blur. So he believes that this phenomenon is mostly created by that. And he shoots like a paintball with some of his cameras to show the effect.
I thought it was funny that one of the grad students covered their ears for the paintball. Like it was like an actual gun.
What a wimp. And the paintball didn't actually produce the effect exactly like they wanted. However, a little bit of the paintball fell off and it did make a rod.
Right.
So that was pretty cool. Mm-hmm. So then we go back to Peter and his cameras, and Doug is there. Our guy, Doug.
Yeah, we see Doug. I was like, hey, there's Doug.
Yeah, it's our boy, Doug. If you haven't listened to that, make sure to go listen to our interview with Doug Hijack, the creator of Monster Quest. And he is on this episode himself. He's out there doing the thing. So good to see him.
Yeah.
And so he and Peter, you know, they set up their cameras. They got the timing. They shake up the ground. They had somebody go over there and like hit a bush.
And they made sure that the narrator said that several times. They said, camera crew shakes the bush to stir up rods.
Because yeah, they're out there doing the dirty work.
And there they are, and all the rods come out.
Yep, and then the moths fly by, and when you look on the high-speed camera, you see moths. When you look on the standard camera, what do you see, Trey?
You see rods. They're literally rods. They caught them. It was like the first time they actually caught something, besides the giant squid one.
Ladies and gentlemen, we got them.
And I think now we can say what this phenomenon is. You know, we're kind of just not saying it because I think it's pretty obvious. We're
trying to get
as much mileage as we could out of the topic. But yeah, rods are just a basic phenomenon of camera technology. They are bugs and birds. That's what rods are.
Just product of artifacting and low shutter speed and that kind of stuff, or frame rate. Yeah.
Yeah, because just like with alien UFOs, you know, like people are not very good at seeing and measuring things in the sky. So like if a bug flies close to your camera, you might think it's going extra fast. Mm-hmm. But it's just a bug going in, like a foot from your camera. It'll look way slower if it's going the same speed, you know, 100 feet from your camera and you caught it. Right. You know, it's so like we get these kind of weird things. But the idea of them being a long cylindrical thing with flapping is basically because your camera doesn't catch it all.
Yeah. And it makes sense why they're so inconsistent with rod sizes and colors and the number of wings. There's a really huge inconsistency with the number of wings I found.
Yeah.
Some rods have like 6, some have 4, some have like 20.
they bring this information to Jose and he is not convinced by it.
And he can be unconvinced if he wants, but you're not convinced enough. like it's pretty obvious here.
Another thing I was thinking about the rod phenomenon is if they can't be seen by the naked eye, like at all, right? Like they continue to say, then how are cameras seeing them? Cameras use all the same light that we use. They don't see an infrared or anything.
They must
be visible by the human eye, even if they're fast and difficult to see. They must be, or cameras could not capture them.
Yeah. I don't know why. I've dived into this. This is sort of like there's a whole conspiracy of these skyfish. There's like apparently like sky ecosystems with like sky snakes and sky whales and all kinds of stuff, like
sky big nets. Skyfish. That's why Skynet had to come to get rid of the skyfish, because they're going to take over. That's why it's called Skynet. So they didn't really want to hurt us, but the sky ocean was a real threat to us. So.
Yeah, there's like this whole conspiracy of people who believe in a sort of like atmospheric ecosystem where there's giant skyfish that eat small skyfish and all kinds of crazy stuff. And they apparently they live their entire lives without touching the ground. And when they die, their bodies are so fragile and transparent that they disintegrate before they reach the ground, or when they reach the ground. That's why there's no physical evidence of them. It's a little crazy, and there's people who like believe that they're like the descendants of like Anomalocaris and like these early sort of primitive animals. It's crazy. There's sky jellyfish. It's not real. So I like JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, which is like this really good manga anime series, and the rods are in it. That's and the great. author makes this really elaborate. It's oddly elaborate how he tries to explain how rods exist in his universe, and that they're descendants of like Anomalocaris, and like they eat people's heat, and they're so fast that you can't even see them, and stuff. They eat people's bodies. Heat. That's what they feast off of. So there's that. Hey, rods are interesting, but they're not real. and they're pretty easy to screw.
I could be wrong, but I remember watching this episode back in the day, right? Like, I remembered it pretty good. And I also kind of, like, don't remember this phenomenon sticking around. Like, yeah. I don't hear people talk about it anymore. I think that this is one where it's a fucking bug. Like, people buy that. I think even, like, a lot of people interested in cryptids kind of just buy that it's a bug theory. So,
yeah, it's kind of one of those weird. It's one of the few examples where you see, like, a cryptid has died. Like,
everyone's like, yeah, that's bullshit.
Rod believers aren't really that prominent anymore.
Yeah, I was looking on YouTube. There's not very many new rod videos. Like,
yeah, I think it plateaued out probably because the cameras got way better and they don't have
definitely
that sort
possible.
Of
I don't know enough about that to be sure, but I thought that could definitely be true. So you might be right. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, and I want to talk about the Crawfordville monster. and how, like, so people have taken this story. Rod believers really like this story.
This part isn't in the Monster Quest episode. We kind of just finished what's in there, but the Crawfordville monster obviously is real and much more important, so we're gonna pivot to that.
Well, it's an interesting story where like, people use the version where it appears to a whole town in broad daylight, which just isn't the fact. It appears in a newspaper, I think September 5th, 1891, or just about that time. And the newspaper, it was only picked up by one of four in that town. And so it seems like it was done for sensationalism. Because there's no evidence of, like, any other newspaper picking it up in that area, especially for, like, the mass witness event. Yeah, there's no evidence of that. For the two Icemen, that's, like, the original story. It's possible, but again, it's like at 2 a.m. and it's like two guys. And there was a follow-up like interview with people in that town around that time. And the theory is that two guys tracked down the monster or something like that, and they found out it was a flock of seagulls. It might have been a flock of seagulls that was I was going to make that same joke, but I wasn't sure.
Did you know that song's actually about a UFO?
Is it really?
Yeah, the song's about him seeing a UFO and running from it. Yeah.
Really?
Paranoid about it, catching up to it.
I got to look at their lyrics. I never realized that. Yep. That's awesome. Yeah, apparently. So anyways, the reason why the monster showed up, the monster, which is a flock of over 100 seagulls or something, was because the town installed electric lamps for the first time around that time, like that week. And so it messed up the birds. The birds were freaking out with it. So they hovered over the city.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Monster.
It made a weird shape. So there's the Crawfordville monster.
Darn.
It's probably just a whole bunch of seagulls.
Yeah, I don't believe you. I believe the story of the wailing, dying, like, space.
Breathing on people. Atmosphere.
Yeah, I believe that, man.
I would love to believe in sky whales. Sky whales is such a cool concept. Yeah. But
so for the Flock of Seagulls song, the second verse, right? It's a cloud appears above your head. A beam of light comes shining down on you. The cloud is moving near still. Aurora Borealis comes in view. Aurora comes in view.
How come I never noticed this?
And then verse three is, reach out to touch your face. You're slowly disappearing from my view, appearing from my view. Reach out a hand to try again. I'm floating in a beam of light with you, a beam of light with you.
Damn. Wow, I never realized that. That's amazing.
Yep, it's a UFO abduction love song.
That's cool.
Like, maybe they knew this story. Maybe they knew.
Yeah, they based it off of the 1891.
Dude, we uncover so much shit on this. So breaking news. Flock of Seagulls band was named after this monster.
After the Crawfordville one? Where did the band originate from?
England.
They were in England. Oh, crap. So that's a little bit far from Indiana. But
yeah, we got a special relationship, the British and us. Yep. Well, thank you, everybody, for listening to this episode.
Yes, thank you.
The Monster Quest is a little weird one. Like, obviously, rods are just bugs. I know that it kind of sucks. It's kind of boring. But we tried to make it as fun as we could for this episode. What would you rate this one, Trey?
You know what? I would rate it a 6. It's a solid episode, I think. I think there were some good, like that camera shutter speed experiment or whatever. Great. I think that was an awesome little experiment right there that anybody can try at home.
I'm going to give this one a 7.
7, okay.
And nice. And the reason why is I think they debunked it pretty much in that damn episode.
Yeah, I think so too.
They literally reproduce the phenomenon. That's kind of science, right? Yeah. Like they're like, everyone's seeing a phenomenon. They're like, well, can we reproduce it? And in a controlled environment? I mean, it's not perfectly controlled, but you know, it's pseudo controlled environment. And they did. And after that, they're kind of like, yeah. And I bet if I message Doug, he will tell me that he doesn't believe in rods. I think he kind of thought this one was stupid, which is why he like let all the explanations in there, you know? So it has a 5.8 on IMDb, so it's not one of the more liked ones. But
you know what? You convinced me. I'm going to move mine up to a 7 as well.
Heck yeah,
I agree.
I think I'm going to put on our ratings and so see what gets. Let's go back and listen and get our ratings all marked. let's check out some of the comments here before we go.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, let's see. Here's a good one. Wow, bugs flying close to a video camera really sets people on fire.
Even the YouTube comments aren't really believers.
Right. Even those dudes are just like, yeah, man. So I'm saying this one didn't catch on. I feel like it's a failed cryptid, the rod.
Let's see. Their wings are like stingrays.
I guess. The membrane version, yeah.
I'm trying to find, what's this guy? This guy has the exact same haircut as the optical physics in my dream.
Oh, well, that's a weird thing to say, man.
Weird comments. What about germs and microbes with those fin wing things and underwater animals with cilia that fly like that and eels and snakes?
Those who live in a completely different environmental area, and so they evolved different adaptations to move. It requires more energy to fly than it does to float in the water. So there's the answer to that question.
I believe it's a bug also. There you go. They convinced this guy.
This person says, I would have called the rod shooting stars or asteroids. I see them a lot in August. Okay.
These comments are so weird.
Yeah.
We are not alone. They have a little UFO.
It's always that, right? Aliens are so unfalsifiable. Like, you always kind of get away with saying it's aliens.
Oh, well, it's funny that, so the Cave of the Swallows, is that what it's called?
Yeah, which is an awesome name, by the way.
That's brought up in JoJo. So it seems like the author watched this episode of Monster Quest, which I think is really
if the author of JoJo's Bizarre Adventures would like to come on our show and talk
Rocky.
About, yeah, he wants to come on. He's definitely welcome.
Yeah, he's allowed. That'd be fun. We could talk about cryptids.
My friends, all my weird friends, my weebish friends, they always want me to watch that show.
So. Yeah, it's good. It's not bad.
I'm not criticizing. I just haven't seen it.
So it's a power related to this stand, which is like a magic power, and the power's name is Skya.
Yeah. So here's one. I remember hearing about rods on the Art Bell Show. Look them up. You'll find a radio version of Discovery Channel, only better.
Oh, we love the coast to coast.
Is a word you can use to describe our relationship with that show.
It's interesting. It's with Mel's hole.
Yeah. It's a love-hate thing. Yeah. Well, that's rods, everybody.
That's rods.
And that's Atlantis. And you know what? That's the show.
Yeah.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Have fun.
Yeah. I'll be at Comic-Con soon, and Trey's studying to become even better at science, so we'll be gone for a bit, but we recorded this episode in the past to release it to you now in the future, so be safe out there.
Yeah, you guys be safe.
All right. Goodbye.
See ya.
Won't you let me be bottled up?